Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with Elizabeth Hamilton Garino, here to help you find success in all areas of your life. The power is in your hands. Join our network for free at besteveryou.com. And now, here's Elizabeth.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Best Ever You Show. We are doing a special show here at night for you. if you hear me coughing a little bit or clearing my throat, I have been pretty down sick for 3 weeks. So we're just kind of finally back up these past 2 days. And what better way to heal than do a radio show? So here we are. I've got a great guest. I have Dr. Utter with me. And I did not get a chance to talk to you before the show. We came in hot.
Yes, your name?
Jerry Lynn?
Yes, that's correct. You got it.
I just want to make sure I had total pronunciation right. So Dr. Jerry Lynn Utter is with me. She's the author of Aftershock, and we can kind of joke around a little bit. We're both fellow HCI authors, but this is our first time meeting. Welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Elizabeth. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I figured we had a time zone goof, did we? Were we on different time zones?
I think it might have been a time zone thing, and then I think just like a schedule conflict thing, but we're here now, so it worked out.
It's perfect. Yeah, we were going to do this show earlier, and it was so loud in my house with them cleaning the gutters outside and some other things going on that I was just like, I can't do this at 11 o'clock. So here we are. I am so excited to have you here. And just have like a girl-to-girl, conversation with our audience here that's listening live about your book. And I'm going to – do you mind if I just like dive right in?
Oh, please. Yeah, sure.
Okay. I'm going there. I'm going right to your childhood.
okay.
I'm just going to say this. When you look at people, you can never tell things that are going. I remind people constantly about this. You can never tell by looking at someone what's gone on in their life, what's going on in their life, anything. And so it's very important to stop, pause, and be kind to every single person that you meet, because you have no idea what's going on in their life or what they've been through. And from there, I hope you take it away and just maybe start at your childhood, because it sounds like it was turbulent, to put
it
bluntly.
I was just going to say that's a really nice way to describe it. But, I mean, I think, both of my parents struggled with addiction and alcoholism. But I think what kind of adds another layer to that is just there was a lot of trauma. So both of my parents and their, family of origin had a lot of significant trauma, domestic violence, verbal abuse. And I think that carried on into their own relationship. But one thing that I think that my parents did for me was kind of break that generational trauma when it came from a physical perspective. So I was never really the victim of any physical abuse by my parents, but also from a verbal perspective. My parents, despite a lot of the problems that they had, they never really verbally kind of abused me or talked down to me or called me out of my name. And I think that's a lot of what helped me develop a really healthy self-concept, despite kind of being drugged through the ringer of all of the things that they did. So, being evicted, being homeless, not knowing where my next meal was coming from, dealing with their partners who were very abusive. So when they separated, their partners were, my mom's boyfriend and my dad's, girlfriend were abusive, and they abused each other. And they would beat and physically hurt each other, both my parents, and then also when they left each other with their respective partners. So even though I wasn't kind of directly abused in that way, I was a part of that. I witnessed a lot of that. And I think that really kind of impacted me and scared me. And as a kid, I remember always feeling very unsafe and not feeling protected. And I think I carried that with me. So one of the things that came out of that for me was kind of going down this like perfectionistic, high achieving route, because in my mind, I thought if I can be great at everything and if I could be really good at everything, then that's a way for me to protect myself, because people will treat me well instead of treat me poorly, if that makes any sense.
Sure. Yeah, I've got a lot of questions. I'll see if I can get them out of me here with my cold still. Wow, yeah, that's a lot going on there, and I think sometimes you just have to almost do the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about that. You know, you just do like I'm not doing that. Did you ever have a moment where you started to go down their path and went, I'm correcting, or were you just like, wash your hands of it? I'm not being this way. How'd that go for you?
I was more, yeah, I think how that went for me is when my parents had moments of sobriety, my dad especially was really good at not hiding things. So he would kind of use their mistakes and their struggles as an example. So I can remember as far back as being 5 and 6, like just school age, my dad talking to me about a monster that lived inside my brain. And a lot of people in today's world would say, oh, that's terrible. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't kind of compare addiction to a monster. But my dad did. And he said to me, you know, it's asleep now, but, you know, you don't want to be like me and mom. And me and mom, you know, abused drugs. And me and mom, you know, abused alcohol. And you have that in you. So, Jerry Lynn, for you, it's different. Like, you shouldn't, you know, drink and you shouldn't smoke because you can wake up that monster. You don't want to end up like me and mom. So that was kind of a conversation that I had. It started very young, and I had that opportunity to have that conversation with my father, prompted by him, you know, leading through to my early teens. And I think playing those tapes in my head is what kind of scared the crap out of me to kind of go the other way, because I'm like, I don't want to be like you guys. And my dad was like, you don't want to be like us. You don't want to live paycheck to paycheck. You don't want to be involved in this criminal lifestyle. And when he kind of put it in the perspective of, look, we're living in a two-room, not a two-bedroom. We're living in a two-room efficiency. Your mom's cooking on a hot plate. We don't know where the next meal is coming from because of our addiction. When he kind of broke it down for me in a way where I could see that I was suffering, it scared me enough to be like, I don't want this. I just don't want this for myself because I don't want to live like this. So I think that was a big part of the motivation, was the way he broke it down kind of just completely deterred me, because I'm like, I'm not going there. I don't want this life for myself. So I think that's kind of what really helped me. And the self-concept part's important, because my father was always like, you can do anything you put your mind to. Like, you know, when you doubt yourself as a kid and you go through those yucky teenage years and you think like, I don't fit in, or I'm not smart, or I'm not good looking, or I'm not this and I'm not that. My dad more so, you know, was just very like, no, like you're Jerry Lynn, like you can do anything. Like, you're talented, you're smart, you're gifted. And I think that is also what really, really helped me know that I want it better for myself. At least now, Elizabeth, like, if you look at it, you know, psychodynamically, or if you look at it from the perspective of a psychologist, at least that's how I have intellectualized my upbringing in a way for me to be able to deal, and for me to not
deal
resent
with
my parents and hate them. Exactly. So there could be, there could be some of that. I can't give my dad like all this credit. I mean, he put me through some pretty crappy situations, but I think it's part of that too. I intellectualized and conceptualized it in a way that felt good for me.
Yeah. Cause you can't change it. So you're going to have to cope and deal. So good for you. And I don't know how to say that right, but you know, good for him for having some awareness of you, I guess. The glimpses, the glimmers of whatever you got there seem to help in some form. But, wow. Did they ever sober up or get their lives together and in order and knock it off? And how – that's my first question. And I was going to say, and if they didn't, like, how frustrating is that? Like, but first part first,
Yeah, first part and things like that, people never talk about what's called transfer addiction. So to answer your question, my dad went from heroin in the 60s and 70s to methamphetamine abuse in the 80s to then being quote-unquote sober. So he was sober from the time I was about 5 to 12. And he had the brilliant idea to buy a bar in the neighborhood where I grew up with him, which is the Kensington section of Philadelphia, really, really rough section. Yeah. And you see it in the news all the time now for drugs and fentanyl and xylazine. And once he bought that bar, he woke up another monster, and that monster was alcohol. So he went from hard drugs to alcohol. And what my dad did to justify it was say, I'm not hurting anybody. You know, I'm not hurting anyone. I'm not in jail. I'm not doing anything wrong. But he became severely addicted to alcohol. And that in the end is what created a lot of health issues for my dad. And he ended up passing away pretty young from pancreatic cancer. But that's what happened to my dad. It went from hardcore drug use to alcohol, and the alcohol was minimized because it wasn't as bad as it was before, but nonetheless, it was bad, you know, and it still didn't end well. And my mom still struggles. My mom just celebrated her 71st birthday. She was a binge drinker all through her 20s. Into her 30s, she liked Quaaludes back in the day, and then she liked benzos, and then when she was in her 40s, was introduced to Percocets, and then that transitioned to heroin, and then as everybody knows, heroin is kind of a delicacy in the illicit drug market. Then she transitioned into fentanyl, and the last time she used fentanyl was in like right around 2020, but same thing with my mom, transfer addiction. So she picked up binge drinking again and just recently got out of rehab again for the 100th time and seems to be doing okay, but I've noticed a couple lapses here and there. So it's still a struggle with my mom, for real.
Mm. Do you think there's anything anybody can do? But with the, you
like
know,
some...
just, I mean, it just doesn't seem to, some, these rehabs and all this stuff, it just doesn't seem to work. I just want to appeal to like all the people on behalf of all the people out there who struggle with this. Is there anything that actually works?
I think the answer to that question is a lot more simpler than we have complicated it. So it doesn't matter where you are. You can be in the bougiest, prettiest, most gorgeous rehab that has yoga by day and homemade, you know, prepared chef meals at night. It doesn't matter where you are. When you're ready to get sober, you'll get sober anywhere. So to answer that question, it doesn't matter. Children crying, screaming. I've been there. I've been that child crying, screaming. The fear of losing your children, the fear of losing your career, your home, everything, your health, none of that matters until the person who is in active addiction is ready. They have to want it. They have to be ready, and they have to be motivated. And there's nothing that anyone, even their children or their partner, can say or do to influence that motivation. That motivation has to come from within. It cannot be something that's used to threaten them or something that's used to be held over their head, because in active addiction, they risk their own life and safety. So if they're risking their own life and safety, you know, nothing dupes that, so let alone a loved one. So really, it's they have to want it. And when you want it, and I've seen it as a practitioner who specializes in co-occurring issues, who specializes specifically with substance use disorders and alcohol, I've gotten the opportunity to bear witness to it, to observe somebody actually make it. And it's really cool to see, because I've never got to see it from my own parents, but I've gotten a chance to see it with other people, and that's been kind of healing.
Yep. if you want to take a pass on this one, you can. Have you personally struggled with any of the addictions as the result of whatever?
No, I've been fortunate. I have, like I said, when my dad started to have those talks with me, I steered clear. Even, you know, as a teenager and going away to college, I wasn't a big drinker, you know, wasn't into smoking weed. Even to this day, I may have a glass of wine maybe a couple of times a month, if that, and I still hear his voice. And I don't like to lose. Again, I went the other way. I need to be in control. And for me, if using or drinking is going to make me feel out of control, or if it's something that I'm going to have to depend on to get through a hard time, I'm scared to death. So I personally have been blessed with not struggling, even though the cards have been stacked against me. But again, I really think early education with your kids is so important. followed by helping them develop a strong self-concept, not to be confused with pumping their heads up and making a little, you know, a little narcissist, but definitely like helping them understand what they're good at, you know, that they're good people, that they have good things, and talking to them about drugs and alcohol early. And when you talk to them, don't talk at them, like talk with them and share some of the crappy things that you've done as a parent, because you are human, and humanize it for them. I do it with my kids. We just came from seeing my mom, and you know, she didn't look too hot, and I, you know, my kids observed that, and we talked about it. I didn't brush it under the table or make an excuse. I said, yeah, I think you're right. I think something's going on here, and I'm glad that you're observant, and look, you see what it does. So just being open and honest and having that conversation early and often, I think really helps.
Yeah, I thought one of the things I thought about you was that you'd be a great guest for people who are just don't, you know, you're like me or I'm like you, whatever you want to say. I just have had a life of non-drinking, non-smoking, non-drugs, non-prescription drugs. In fact, I am so allergic to so many things that it just doesn't place well in Peoria. So I thought you would be kind of a cool guest from that standpoint, because it doesn't say anywhere in any of your materials, yep, she lives a sober life of not drinking, not smoking, not doing this and that, maybe an occasional glass of wine. That's not in here, but I kind of read through the lines and went, I bet. And
yeah.
what I'm wondering is, I'm seeing it more and more on Instagram now. I'm sorry, I'm clearing my throat a little bit here and there. I apologize. Seeing it more and more that there's these sober societies, and it's sort of trending in the other direction to not drink alcohol. And it's not so popular anymore in some circles. Are you seeing this?
Mm-hmm.
And how, I got another question for you here too. I'm going to just tie it all together. I think, isn't it lonely sometimes? People are like, oh, did you go through rehab? So many questions leveled at me, just thrown at me so many times in so many different directions. When I'm like, no, I don't drink. Oh, you're recovering, huh? I'm like, no, I'm not recovering. I just chose at about the age of born to just be a non-drinker. The stuff is just like poison.
Making me laugh. I can't even hold it in, because I just had this conversation with my husband. Husband has never had any problems with drugs or alcohol and just doesn't drink. And we went to when we go to parties, and he says, Matt, like, I'm cool, I'll have a cranberry juice. It's an opposite stigma, and it's almost like an opposite bullying. We revert back to teenagers. Like, what do you mean, man? Like, what do you mean you don't drink? And he's like, I don't know, man. I just don't drink. Are you in recovery? No, I'm not in recovery. I just don't like the taste. Like, I don't like the way it makes me feel. Don't drink. And it's so weird that we have to, as adults,
explain to myself
why we don't want to drink.
And I'm like, how many kids do you have?
Me?
Yeah. How many kids?
I have two. I have a 12-year-old boy and a 9-year-old girl.
Okay. So I have four sons, and they're 22, 24, 26, and 28. I'm now 54. And our kids they're not real big drink, you know, not into all the stuff. And the way I trained them was like, I'm like, no one knows what's in your cup.
Right.
Nobody. Nobody knows if that's water, vodka, rum and Coke, just Coke. No one knows but you. Keep it covered, keep it near you, and keep it, you know, non-alcohol. And let's see how you do. And, you know, it's interesting. It's real interesting.
What's funny as you're saying that, again, I'm smiling again because my kids aren't there yet, but I'm going to do that. Like, I'm literally pulling that from you, and I will totally give you the credit for it. Because it's true, like, no one knows what's in your, and to have to feel obligated, and I think it happens a lot as kids and teenagers. And you can do a Sprite and pretend, but what do we teach them? Like, oh, well, you know, in order not to get too much shade thrown your way, you know, you can say it's vodka. I remember as a kid, I hung out with a crowd that was really into some stuff, and you know, they would call me Sister Jerry as if I was a nun.
I've been called, I dressed as a nun in college for Halloween. Yeah. Every year.
And they were like, but, you know what was cool? And I said this to my kids. I said, you can call me Sister Jerry. Once I said no, and once they knew that I was like, nah, man, I'm not into it, they didn't bother me. And even though like they weren't the best group of kids, they were cool with me, and they didn't pressure me or make me feel bad. They just were like, all right, Sister Jerry, and they didn't bother me. And I kind of respected that about them because, you know, I stood my ground and I said no, and they respected that. And that's what I said to them. I said, you can be Sister Greg or Sister Natalie or Father Greg and Sister Natalie, whatever you know, whatever you're to identify, like whatever, who cares? You know, and I say to them, the people who are really your friends aren't going to care. They're not going to care one way or another, whether you have a drink with them or whether you're sitting there with a Coke or a Sprite or a cranberry juice. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But I absolutely agree with you. And to your other point, and your other point with Instagram, you need to send me some of those pages because I haven't come across it just yet, but I think it's liberating and I think it's cool that, you know, there's a group of people that are just teetotalers and they're just not into it. And I think that there's nothing wrong with that. You know, there's nothing wrong with not wanting to do anything. It doesn't mean that you're in recovery just because you don't. It's just, maybe it's not your thing.
Yeah. And a lot of them are recovering and staying sober and grouping together and things like that. There's a bunch of different groups on Instagram, but there's, I'm going to go back. Don't remind me about driving, because I want to talk to you about kids and driving and stuff like that. But, as I'm talking about this with the different groups, there's a lot of groups that are sober. And then there's a lot of like no drinking. I can't even remember what it is, like no drinking January or sober February or whatever it is.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I personally hate that. I'm like, I'm glad you did it for 4 weeks, but how about no, you know, keep going. You know, it's like everybody goes, oh, thank God, it's whatever day it is. I can drink again. And boom, 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 boom. I call it the undoing. I'm like, no, keep going.
Well, it's like, I want to detox. I want to detox my system for 4 weeks and like, you know, help my liver heal. And then it's, you know, and then it's diving back. Yeah. I have had people though recently that I work with who are anxious, don't have a diagnosis of alcohol use disorder. And what's interesting is one person comes to mind, she did this starting in January and she's still going since last January.
Yay,
and
bravo.
And she's like, I just, you know, like I don't want it to become a crutch when I'm feeling stressed or anxious. And then we talked about a lovely thing called rebound anxiety. It all feels great in the moment when you're numbing out your anxiety with drinking, but it's when you wake up the next day or when you stop that you have a rebound anxiety effect that's 100 times worse than why you were drinking it to begin with. Like you were drinking to manage angst, then you drank, and now you're not drinking, and you've realized your anxiety's turned up 5 more notches. And that's something that's not talked about a lot either, and something for folks to just be mindful of.
The other thing, too, is I always say this, and it sounds, I don't know, sometimes I think I come off like a jerk saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Sorry. You don't fool anybody either. That's the thing. People think they hide their pot smoking and their drinking and all this crap, and they think they're like, they call it like, oh, well, I'm a functioning this or that. And
mm-hmm.
I'm like,
mm-hmm.
Listen, as a non-everything, I can smell it. I can see your eyelashes gone. I can see your hair thinning. I can see the color of your skin. I can see your nails. I can see so many things that tell me that you have problems.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not fooling anybody.
Right. And I feel
I have
like
my own problems.
People...
I'm not saying that I'm problem free, but you know, knock on everything.
I totally get it. And again, you have me smiling again, not in a bad way, but you're just hitting on so many things that, especially when you work with people in active addiction that may be in denial or people who are struggling with addiction and don't even realize it yet, they really think they do a great job of masking it. And I'm like, you're not. And I think for us, or at least for me, on the receiving end of that, it can get very aggravating because, you know, we are smarter than you think, and we do observe things, and it's, you know, I would have much more respect and a lot less resentment if you just said, I drank all day
or whatever. At least I know then, you know. The other thing I was going to say, back to the kids, One of the things that I taught my kids that might help you with 12, the 12-year-old and younger, because, you know, once they hit 10, they're exposed to drugs and alcohol in school. It's everywhere. It's in the bathrooms. And I mean, it's everywhere. So, and you don't have a driver yet, but we said to our kids the same thing that everybody says, you know, if you ever need, maybe people don't say this, but we did. If you ever need a ride anywhere, any situation, anything, you call us. We will come get you. I don't care if you throw up all over me or in the car or whatever you do, or if your friends do or whatever. If you're in a situation where any of you need help, you call. And we've had two of those.
Nice.
In, yeah. And total puking in the car. So, and their friends, not them. And then the other thing I would say is we said to all of our kids, you know, there's a this or that going on. Be the sober one and be the driver.
Mm-hmm.
And that has served them so well, so many times to get out of it. And it's sad that you have to kind of get out of it so you don't get crap, but that has served them well. Give me your keys.
I'm using that too.
Driver.
Stealing that too. Thank you very much. I have said, cause I have a younger sister who's 28 and I'm 43. So we're about 15 years apart and I adopted her at 10. And just due to, like, we share the same mom. So I kind of went through it with her. It's different, though, until, like, you have a child from birth all the way through. But I remember kind of, like, saying that stuff to her. I'm like, you know, because she's like, well, what if you're mad at me and if I was drinking and I don't care. Like, that has, I'm not even concerned about that at that point. I just want you to know you're never in trouble. If you got drunk and you weren't supposed to, clearly, at 16, 17, whatever, 19, that's not the issue. Like, we're not going to even address that. I will come get you. I'm not going to scream. Don't worry about getting in trouble. The fact that you called me could have saved your life and other people's lives. So, and then we'll talk about the other stuff later. But, like, I will come get you no matter what.
Yeah, because what's really going to piss me off is the accident you're in. You know,
yep.
or whatever it is.
Yep.
It's like, no, that's where you get mad. So you got to, you know, you have the perspective of what's, you know, what's life or death, and getting behind the wheel of anything in impaired is life or death for you and for the other people involved. So, yeah, I that's the one thing I really hate is drinking and driving really bad.
Oh, yeah.
And all the impaired driving, whatever it is these days. Okay. That was a good chat about everything, and I think that was helpful. I hope that was helpful for people. I don't know. But we have 10 minutes left, if you can believe it or not. We have, like, 10 minutes left. let's talk about your book. So the book is called Aftershock. You've actually got a couple books and a documentary. So tell me the names of your books first and the documentary.
So the first book I wrote is called Mainlining Philly, Survival, Hope, and Resisting Drug Addiction, and that was kind of like a memoir. And I wrote that book in order to help people like me who didn't suffer with addiction, and I was never addicted, but I was very much collateral damage, or I suffered the collateral damage from my parents, and it's kind of written from that perspective and also provides a lot of kind of I would say resources and also just insight into how you can deal with it as a family member who loves someone who's addicted. So that's Mainlining Philly. Then the second book that I wrote was Aftershock, How Past Events Shake Up Your Life Today. And initially I was writing this during COVID to talk about everything happening from a trauma perspective with COVID. And then, you know, in working with the editor that I work, like my own personal editor, I was like, you know what, there's probably a lot coming out on this. And I don't know how many more books could come out on this. So let's talk about something that no one talks about and a lot of people overlook. And that's what's called, what we would call, like, a subclinical form of trauma. So it's not PTSD, which is clinical. We have that in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Psychiatric Disorders. So it's not a clinical diagnosis. What aftershock is, it's a delayed subclinical trauma response. What does that mean in English? In English, it means as humans, we're going to go through some crappy things. We're going to lose someone that we love. A lot of people may have will experience a terrible breakup in their life. It doesn't have to be marriage, but it can be a marriage. It can be a serious relationship. Some people struggle with IVF. Some people will lose their dream job. Some people will change careers. So there's these things that will happen to us throughout the lifespan that are part raising kids, giving birth. Like, there's a lot of things that are quote unquote traumatic that we don't talk about. And that's considered like an ordinary trauma because, you know, everybody will lose a parent. We kind of chalk it up to it happens to everyone. You'll get over it. But, and you will, and you do, but the book sheds light on what that looks like for people. So a perfect example is divorce. You're married, go through this terrible divorce. The divorce process can take whatever, let's just say a year, 2 years. And during that time, you'll go through all of these kind of stages of grief. You'll hate the person, then you'll feel better. Then you might go out and it'll be like, you know, I'm woman, hear me roar. I'm going to go out and have fun and I'm going to start dating again. And then you ink the paper and you're like, this, I'm done with this person and I finally have a custody arrangement or whatever. And the worst, what you think of as the worst is behind you. Like you're looking at it in the rearview mirror. But then you notice you're irritable. You're not sleeping right. You're feeling a little anxious, maybe a little depressed. And you say to yourself, I don't know why I feel like this because I signed the divorce papers 2 months ago. And that's what we call a delayed trauma response. So even though you were kind of in the survival mode to get through the trauma in real life time, your body and your brain still has, you know, keeps the score, right? Your body and your brain still kind of is dealing with that. And you can still have a mental health concern or kind of like not feel like yourself as a result of that. So aftershock is just that, it's the aftershock of a trauma. And you're kind of just, I want to bring awareness to it because I feel like in order for somebody to talk to a therapist, they feel like they have to have this clinical diagnosis or they have to have this big problem. You don't. If you're not feeling like yourself, if you're going through a tough time, like raising kids is really hard. I think anybody raising kids will benefit from therapy at some point in time. And we all do it. A lot of us do it. A lot of people have kids. So it's kind of like just, it's breaking that down. Like crappy things are going to happen, right? And you don't have to do it. You don't have to go at these crappy things alone. And these crappy things are going to make you feel like crap. Though it's normal, it shouldn't be dismissed. Yeah. You can still address it. So that's kind of what aftershock's about. And I use, you know, very colloquial, informal language, but I also use patient conceptualization.
Yeah, I think I'm just loving you, especially when you have a doctor on. It's like, and if you feel like crap, give me a call. And that's what you need, you know, it's like when you're doing it, it's going to be like a tagline for you. When you feel like crap,
call me.
Yeah, and that's true because, you know, just one little phone call can pivot you in the right direction. It doesn't mean you're, you know, in therapy for a year or dealing, you know, that it doesn't have to be so dramatic. It could just be like, hey, I need outside eyes on this. Outside eyes and ears and a heart on what I'm going through. What do you think? You know, and
that's exactly
and
it.
It's lovely. I have a question for you, and this is going to talk about COVID because, oh my God, you know, we've all been through whatever we've been through with that. And we are all, I don't care what anybody says, we are all a little traumatized from it. I see people still, like, I'm just going to go personal on this a little bit. When COVID came around, my husband was like, okay, flip a coin. Who's going into the grocery store and out into the crowd? You know, right. Like, oh, you know, who's going in at the allotted time with their mask on and their, you know, full gear and all of it. And we have a COVID remnant. He still right now pretty much does most of the grocery shopping.
Yeah.
He's still going out and stuff like that. So we have not lost some of the things that we've done with COVID. It's like, oh, well, that just became his thing and he kind of likes it now and all this stuff. But truth be told, I'm like, I'm still kind of terrified. I'm terrified. I wouldn't say terrified. You know, I've certainly been out and about, but I do think events, crowds, people, you know, I went to the T-Swift concert and the whole time I'm like, oh God, I'm going to get COVID. And then, you know, having been so sick the past 3 weeks after going to the T-Swift movie, I'm like, oh, we know where we got this probably, you know, that kind of thing. We've all been through things. Can you, I don't know. Can you make that better for us in any way, shape or form? Are we all still a little bit off?
I think I think the one thing that I can do that I've done for myself, because, you know, I'm not normal. Whatever. First of all, let's throw normal out the window.
Whatever normal
I'm still trying
is,
to figure
yeah,
out what that is. Yeah, what is that? I think the best way that I can make anybody feel better about it, myself included, is you have to do what works for you. And, you know, we went through, that was prolonged trauma. That would be considered more of a complex trauma because it went on for a long time. And it was consistent barrage of bad news. Every television station you turned on, everywhere you went, it was there. So I think it's going to take time for that to undo itself. And it may not. Just like, you know, people who've experienced severe traumas, like things like war, and they're kind of programmed, you know, if food, for example, was something that wasn't readily available, if you think about the Great Depression and things like those, think about, you know, my grandparents, you know, the way that they looked at food and managed food and treated food throughout their lifespan because they had none stayed with them. And they did what they had to do to feel better, whether that was saving or freezing or however they did that, as a remnant or a result of that trauma. So I think the advice I would have is that it's okay. If you have a system set up in your house that's working, you know, for you as far as, you know, yeah, crowds or who's going to food shop, and if it makes you feel a little bit better, I think that that's completely okay. I do think it'll take time. Time is fine. And, you know, again, if you notice that the key is if you notice that it's messing with your daily functioning, with your ability to work, with your ability to do things in your normal schedule, if it's impacting your productivity, then that's when you call somebody like me and we can talk about it.
Yeah.
You can reach out for outside help. But yeah. I'm not here. I think it's okay. You know, I think people are entitled and have a right to do what they need to do to feel better about this. If it's using hand sanitizer, you know, 5 times a day, so be it. Use hand sanitizer 5 times a day. Again, you don't want it to impede your daily life, but you need to do what you need to do to kind of move through this.
Well, I think you just made such a great point with, we've all been through something and it does change you into the way you think about some things. And
yeah,
like, I wasn't the one on the news fighting for the toilet paper or anything like that, but I will tell you to this day, there's a really big thing of toilet paper upstairs. You know, like, I'm never going through that again. And I think you're right. You know, there's certain things I'm like, oh, I don't want to. Because we, you know, in our stores here, and I'm in Maine, you know, we ran out of stuff. And I'm like, okay. And it makes you think, like, your she cub protector goes on. It's like, okay, are we running out of food? Or is everybody getting sick? That feeling of, like, what's going to happen to us is a really scary thing. And I think I kind of just in my head, I was kind of like, well, this wouldn't be so bad if it was just us, but there's 4 kids and oh my God, what's going to happen to them? And you know, all these things, we were racing around getting people from college and then they went online and they did all this stuff. And it was just so, I'm very proud of them. And I tell them this all the time for the way they adapted, because they really did a really good job, because we have a college baseball player who missed seasons, all sorts of stuff. A freshman in college who got there and had to turn around and come back, you know, all the things that people went through, and our neighbors had kids in high school, and just, you know, we've all been through a lot. And so I do still think people are kind of talking about what they went through with COVID. I do. I mean, I really do. I think people like to pretend they're not. But I think if you talk about it, people are listening.
Oh, I agree. I definitely agree. And the other thing, when it comes to kids, and when I say kids, I mean school-aged kids all the way through to college. I've noticed, from, you know, as somebody who works with adolescents, the impact that it had on their mental health. And I feel like we're still catching up, because my husband's been a school teacher for over 20 years in middle school. So we all know middle school is hard regardless of COVID. And getting those kids, right, and even getting those kids now coming into middle school that were homeschooled for that period of time, a lot of kids who were homeschooled for that period of time, behaviorally, mental health perspective, I mean, we're seeing a significant increase in depression and anxiety, social anxiety. And I think a lot of that is contributed to COVID and the fact that, you know, kids were on lockdown and, you know, even though kids academically may hate school, for a lot of kids, school is still an outlet based upon what's going on at home. Because you don't know what happens at home. And it's just an outlet in general. It's a social outlet. Even if you have a great home, it's a social outlet. And that was taken away. So if they're 13 this year or next year, chronologically, take 2 years off of that from a developmental perspective because they lost it. They lost that those 2 years academically but also socially and emotionally. And I think we have to be mindful.
Yeah, I see that in our 24 and 22-year-old also. They're 2 years back.
Okay, yep.
You can see it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And both okay now, but at the time as we were going through it, you're like, oh, wow, okay. Serious impact. Like I have one of our kiddos played baseball at New Haven. They closed down, did all this stuff, and I liked what they did with the college athletes, and I'm rambling a little bit, but with college athletes, if you had COVID, you got extra years to play. So they gave you your years back. Like in high school, you just lost them, but in college, they gave them back to you in some cases. And so our son was like, well, you know, he's like, you know, I can gripe and be all sad about this, or I'm going to try and figure out how to turn this into the best thing ever, which was like, how? And he's like, well, if I do this, I can do this. So he ended up playing 6 years of college baseball got a second master's degree from Georgetown University. He transferred to Georgetown, played baseball and got another master's degree from Georgetown, which then because that book, The Little Bug Went Ka-Choo, his younger brother now goes to Georgetown and is in their medical facilities there. So
that's awesome.
You've got to really stop, pause, and think, okay, this sucked, but what am I going to do about this to make sure my future self is healed as best as it can be? That's what I think. I think you just got to, especially as parents, I think that direction, you know, they're like, what do I do, Mom? And you're like, shit, if I know, I'm going through this too. And there's four of you. And I'm like, oh my God. And I was like, oh man, the laundry's back too, you know, everybody.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm looking at, and I think some of the ways that they maneuvered and the world maneuvered were genius. Because I remember when they first went up. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, I'm rambling.
No, I said, No. I think it's great, but do you know what that's called clinically? What your son did with your clinically, we call that post-traumatic growth. So people will go, that was traumatic, right? Some people may not think it's traumatic. Again, they may minimize it, but especially when you're dealing with college athletes, or you're dealing with college artists, or you're dealing with you know, residencies and rotations and. But they kind of, with your guidance and help and support, they navigate it. And instead of folding, right, or instead of kind of being consumed, because it's easy to be and it's okay to be. I'm not placing any type of judgment on somebody
different.
Who has a hard time.
Yeah.
They navigate it and they became resilient. And we call that post-traumatic growth in psychology because you took the trauma, you went through it, and you may have a hard time, and it may take you a while to get to where you've landed, but you've landed on your feet, and that's what post-traumatic growth is. It's not getting it right the first time or maybe even the second, but your son seemed to be more of a straight line, but with some people, they may have dropped out during this, now they're back. What comes the lesson learned throughout and being able to kind of retrospectively say, I went through a tough time. Yeah, probably didn't make the best decisions, but you know what? I'm here now and I'm getting it done.
Yeah. And there were discussions like that too. It's like, oh, this sucks. And we did, we checked in a lot. Like, are you all right? No, I'm not. You know, that kind of thing. We would get responses of, no, I'm not okay. I feel like crap and this sucks. And all, you know, because I have scientists and they're like, I can't do my labs right. The teachers are too old and they don't know how to do things online. And they were great professors to have in person, but wow, now, and, you know, just all sorts of stuff. And so it's been interesting. And I think, you know, bravo to people for making the best of of a really crappy situation. And I love the concept of this book. And that's where I went with it. I'm like, oh, this is what that means, where you have this, it's like almost like a delayed response, like a, almost like a delayed allergic reaction. It's like I ate that. And then like 8 hours later, here's my allergic reaction. I have really bad food allergies. So, and I didn't really think of it, ever think of it like that. And so it's a really cool book. And I hope a lot of people read it. So it's Aftershock. We got to go. But what's your website?
Yeah, so my website is www.drjerrylynn or drjerrylynnutter.com. And it's my first name is G-E-R-I-L-Y-N-N. So it's D-R and then G-E-R-I-L-Y-N-N.com.
Okay, so I will make sure that website is up here. I've got the on the show, everybody, I've got the website for the book, which didn't the book just come out not too long ago? It's pretty new,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it just came out at the end of September. So yeah, I'm so cool that you're also, you know, we can have a total conversation offline about that. But yeah, so HGI and I think Simon & Schuster is distributing it. So, you know how that works. So, you know, trying hard over here at it to make it a success, but it seems to be doing pretty well.
books are, but being an author is a whole different thing. Everybody listening, you know, it's one thing to have a career and all this stuff and do this. And then you branch out and you're like, oh, okay, I'm going to take my career and I'm going to write a book. And then you're like, okay, writing the book's the easy part. Here's the thing though, like selling the book, finding readers for the book, marketing the book, all this stuff, it makes you wear as an author, like 20 different hats, trying to figure it all out. So, you know,
that's why I'm in therapy. That's why I'm in my own therapy.
Me too.
That's my
Let me just tell you, I'll share my book journey with you sometime. And I almost needed therapy after the first one. I'm like, oh my God, I suck. I went through this like deep, dark, like I'm horrible. This book didn't even remotely sell enough copies and I suck. And it took a long time for me to go from that to, all right, you actually do have something to maybe say to people and help people and do all these things. And the second one went a lot better once I was like, we're going to just whatever, lick some wounds and move along.
You have to be an author and a master marketer, which are two very different things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, very different things. So you do kind of beat yourself up. And you have good days and bad days, but again, that's why I'm in my own. That's one of the reasons why I'm in my own therapy. So even the docs, even us, the good doctors will have their own therapist. It's the ones that don't that everybody should worry about.
They have no place to unload everything that's coming in.
Exactly.
Anyway, it has been a joy to meet you. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for adjusting your schedule because this was scheduled for 11 a.m. Eastern time today. And I find that when I do 11 a.m. shows, even though it was noisy here and everything, I still wanted to move it because you just don't have that live listening crowd that we have at night. So there's a crew here listening to you and they're applauding in the background and thanking you for your time and energy and information and humor. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This was awesome. I felt like I was talking to an old friend. So thank you so much. You're a great host.
That's the show. Well, thank you very much for the compliment. And I've really enjoyed speaking with you and I love your book and everybody. Okay. So here's what we do here at the Best Ever You Show and Best Ever You Network. You know the drill. We have an author on and what do? We go to Amazon and we buy their book and leave reviews, everybody. Amazon, Amazon, Amazon. Us authors these days, we sort of need, almost all books are sold over on Amazon these days and it's a really good benchmark of how well we're doing. So I put the Simon & Schuster link up. I'll put the Amazon link. I'll put Jerry's website link up and off we go. So Dr. Jerry Lynn, thank you very much for being here. And everybody,
thank
go
you.
Get Aftershock. All right, take care, everybody. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. We're so glad you tuned in. Be brave, be bold, be you. And remember to visit us at besteveryou.com.